Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If you drink enough alcohol and you don't pass out first, something strange happens with your brain. You can walk and talk, you can go places and meet people and make decisions, but then wake up the next day with no memory of what you did the night before. Sarah Heppala was surprised the first time somebody told her not every drinker has blackout episodes. Her own love affair with alcohol started in childhood, when she would sip from half-finished cans of beer her mother left in the fridge. Throughout much of her young adult life, Heppala looked to drinking to help with everything from female bonding to dating to her writing career. So when she realized she had to stop, she faced the dual challenge of finding the strength to quit and figuring out who she was without alcohol. Sarah Heppala is the personal essays editor at Salon.com. Her new memoir is called Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. Sarah, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
How did you discover you liked alcohol?
Alcohol happened to me. I think my dad gave me a sip when I was about, I don't know exactly the year, it's 4 or 5, something like that. It's kind of the early edges of memory. And I just loved the taste. It was magic to me. And it was much later, years later, that girls, my friends would tell me, oh, beer's really gross. Like, that's a disgusting taste. And I was like, what are you guys talking about? Beer's the best. It felt like a spark in my veins. You know, it ignited me. And I think, you know, I've talked a lot about what makes a drinking problem and what's an alcoholic, and we can go all day with this stuff. But I think when you think about that, you look at that little girl that takes a sip of beer and it ignites her. You know, that's one of your first clues right there, that there's a genetic component to this. So I started stealing beers, as you said in the intro. My mom is such a non-binge drinker that she would leave half her can of Pearl Light, and I started sneaking sips of it. You know, and I know it's really shocking to some people, especially parents, and it's very disturbing to them to hear this story of a little girl stealing beer. But I always like to emphasize that I know it's shocking, but I don't know that I knew it was so bad. I mean, there's a lot of things that my parents told me not to do, like watch too much television. And as a kid, you're always kind of pushing the envelope, pushing the boundaries, seeing what you can get away with. And I was just sort of swimming towards these warm waters, like this drink that felt good. And I took a few sips and it would make me feel light. And I would spin around in the living room. It was a feeling of warmth across my body that I still remember.
Did you worry as you took on this project that writing about the things you loved about drinking, in addition to all the terrible things that came about because of that, would cause you to want to go back to it?
Euphoric recall is what they call it in recovery, that you have to be very careful not to romanticize. And that there was so much in me of the longing for the drink. There was so much of this romantic mythology around it. But, you know, for me, I wrote this book. I'm 5 years sober now. It's been a long time since I've been that person. And what I really discovered was that drinking doesn't do what I wanted it to do. So I don't crave it in the way that I used to. So in a way, it feels like I'm just telling you stories about my childhood. And I don't want to go back to childhood. And I don't want to drink in childhood, you know. But to me, it felt the only honest way to tell you this story was before I told you the bad stuff that happened, to tell you the stuff that absolutely made me fall in love and was transcendent to me. You know, when I first quit drinking and I would hear people talk about alcohol like the demon drink, I was like, but I loved it, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like when somebody breaks up with a boyfriend and they've been with them for like years and they're like, yeah. he's a horrible person. He's a villain. And you're like, why were you with him for like 7 years, you know? To me, the more fully integrated story is how much I loved it in the beginning and then how tragic that was for me when it turned.
It feels like there are things that you discovered through the process, and we won't give everything away, but there was an incident when you were 13. Were you aware of the trauma that caused before you sat down and started thinking about it sober?
No. And, you know, it's interesting because the act of sobriety is kind of like the act of writing a book, which is investigation into your own life and asking questions and finding connections. It's also the act of therapy. It's also the act of you know, sometimes friendships. And, you know, you're trying to kind of like, let's look at the evidence. What are the connections here? There were so many things in my life that I didn't really see the connections to. And probably the one that was more obvious than any of them was I didn't see what a poster child for blackout I was. I mean, blackouts had been this plague in my drinking life. And when I first sat down with a researcher named Aaron White to talk about blackouts, and he told me the risk factors for blacking out, it was like, you hold your liquor, you skip meals when you're drinking, you drink fast, and you're female, because women don't metabolize alcohol as well as men. And I was just like, what? Like, that's me.
Yeah.
That's me. And so much of this book was about finding connections, finding all these connections between, you know, maybe the way that I was raised or the community that I grew up in, the way that I drank, all of these things. How did they all fit together? You are kind of trying to build that puzzle of, as I ask in the introduction, how did I get here?
So your parents don't live in the same house they lived in when you were growing up.
Now. No.
Okay. So it sounds like you lived on Mockingbird Lane, right?
Lovers
through Highland
Lane.
Park.
Lovers Lane.
Okay.
Lovers in Preston.
You lived in a really fancy neighborhood, and mm-hmm. were from a family of modest means.
Mm-hmm.
How did that affect you?
I think it affected me a lot. I think it affected me a lot. And that's one of those classic stories of the parents doing the thing for the kid, you know?
The best school.
The best school that they could give to us. They wanted the best for my brother and me. And so they moved into this school system, and they just had no idea the kind of social pressures there were around, I don't know, I guess what you have and where you live and what you do, you know, on summer vacations. So when I was in elementary school, I don't think it was as pronounced, but when I got to middle school, as I got older, I would say as I got sort of like the end of elementary and into middle school, it became so blaringly obvious that I did not belong. I did not fit in here. My family didn't fit in here. We were from the Philadelphia area, so there was a little bit of a Yankee go home thing. I mean, you know, it's a cliche, but it's true, you know, and we didn't have this deep social connection that it felt like a lot of my friends' family, you know, their parents had gone to school together and been in sororities together. And there was this whole, it just kind of felt like I'd lost the race before I ever got there. You know, like I just arrived and I've already lost.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's not just about the money. It's also about this sense that everybody else belonged in a fundamental way.
It was so strongly about a sense of belonging. I think I was craving that belonging so much. I was just a kid that I had been deeply connected to my mother. And I just think maybe it was always in me, this just longing to connect and belong. And, you know, and I had friends in elementary school, but as I got older and those social pressures around me intensified and the estrangement intensified, I mean, I was a lonely kid.
So what did alcohol do for you? I mean, there is that sense, I think a lot of people have felt it, where you have a drink or two and you love everybody around you.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. It's that, you know, alcohol does so many things. That's kind of the I've been doing these interviews, and it's like, it's amazing to me how many things alcohol does, because it gives you a sense of belonging. It would soothe my nervousness. I struggled with a lot of shyness. You know, I'm actually really a talkative person. Anybody that knows me knows this about me. But I got really hit with a self-consciousness stick.
Mm-hmm.
And I was that kid that was like, I wanted to say something and I would think about saying something, but I couldn't say it, you know, and I would just spend all the time in my head trying to figure out what I was going to say, but then the window would close and I couldn't say it. And it was like, oh, never mind. And I always had this conflict of wanting people's attention, but then not wanting the scrutiny. Alcohol really helped with that conflict. I mean, you know, you drink and then it's just kind of like, look at me. I mean, I wanted to be the center of the party. But alcohol also will give you a sense of belonging and and comfort, even if you're alone. So it connects you to people when you're with them, and it comforts you when you're away, which is kind of crazy. But it did, and it did all those things for me at different times in my life.
There is a weird kind of cachet, and it's, as you write, a relatively recent one for girls who can drink as much as the guys, you know, when you get into like college age and around that time, there's something, and it's strange that, that young men will go, well, good for you. You can really put it away. It seems odd, but it's true.
There have been so many social restrictions around the way that women drink. We've been told how to behave for so long. Don't do that. And then, and guys have had this freedom to drink however they wanted, that that freedom becomes very appealing to a young woman kind of growing up in the world, you know? If he can do that, I can do that. And yes, you're absolutely right. You get a sense of admiration from both gender tribes, you know, like the girls are kind of like, wow, look at you, you know? And the guys are like, yeah, she can throw back. That was another thing. I mean, you're just, it's so cliched, but like, I wanted that validation. You're a young woman. You want to know, what am I good at? You know, I've been good at writing. Now I'm around people that seem to write just as well as I do. What's my specialness? Well, one of my specialties was that I drank as fast and as fluently as the guys. And I got an enormous amount of, you know, purpose from that, which just sounds like flimsy purpose, but what can I say? You grab onto whatever you can.
The first time you wondered, even in passing, if maybe this was out of control was when you were in college. Mm-hmm. But you were able to look around and think, but look at everybody else. They're drinking as much as I am, without realizing that that would end when most of them got their first real job.
You know, there's there's a saying, you know, it's not alcoholism, it's college. And you see that on the internet all the time. And that was certainly true in my group. You know, we define normal behavior by what's around us, you know. And my drinking was fairly normal. And by normal, I mean that we drank 3, 4, 5 times a week. We raged, as we said. We had ragers. People got very drunk. Some people vomited. Some people did this. Some people did that. I fell down the stairs once. But I did have this really shocking blackout, and it lasted for about 3 hours or something. And it really disturbed and alienated my friends.
Was this the trip to see the Texas OU game?
Yes. I'm not even a football fan, but my worst drinking episode in college was around the Texas OU game. Yes, everybody had gotten into a car and we were drinking bourbon and Coke. And I even remember, I don't think I put this in the book, but I'm kind of a good girl, you know? And I was like, you shouldn't drink while we're driving, you know? But then if they were going to do it, I was going to do it too. I wasn't going to let that stop me. And I started drinking. It was this huge, you know, they pour drinks and, you know, those big free cups that you get,
right?
They're just gigantic. Well, I had one of those and I drank it really fast. And then I drank another really fast. And when we got up to go to the bathroom, I think in like Temple, Texas, which is about 45 minutes away from Austin, that's the last thing I remember. I remember standing at the bathroom and trying to light my cigarette, and somebody came around and said, it's the wrong way in your mouth. And so I turned it around, and that's the last thing I remember. And then I woke up hours later at my parents' house. They were out of town, thank goodness, and I wasn't wearing anything. And this poster of James Dean that I had in my bedroom was pulled off, and I was using it like a blanket. It was just like waking up in this weird Alice in Wonderland world. Like, what has happened here? What are the pieces that connect my last memory with this? But,
you've got a little time.
Oh, okay.
We can come back to the story if you want to, if you want to.
Yeah, I guess I'll talk later about, you know, what happens in a blackout then is that somebody has to come tell you what happened the next day, and that happened when a friend of mine called. So I'll tell you the rest of that story later.
Sarah Heppala is with us. She's personal essays editor at Salon.com. Her new memoir is called Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Sarah Happala, who is personal essays editor at Salon.com and author of the new memoir, Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. You can join us at 800-933-5372. So, Sarah, you have this incident in college, and as happened occasionally, you woke up not knowing what had happened. You sort of started playing Nancy Drew and trying to figure it out. And this time was different because your friends were not amused. It was clear something had happened that really ticked people off.
Yeah. A friend of mine called me the next day and she said, you know, I don't really remember exactly how it came up, but it became clear that I didn't remember what I had done. And she was being a little icy towards me about it. And finally she said, you know, well, you mooned everybody in the car, like, and you mooned everybody on the, it stopped in traffic. And it was like, I did what? And you have to understand, I mean, it's such a kind of like classic Animal House type frat boy thing to do. But one of the things that I go to great lengths in that chapter to point out in the beginning is I have terrible body consciousness. I mean, I avoided pool parties and hot tubs for decades. You know, like I used to wear my flannel shirt tied around my waist, you know, so like nobody could see my lower half. And here I am finding out that in this like drunken state that I don't remember, I had done this egregious thing that was meant, I think I was, it was the classic example of like the drunk person trying to entertain, mm-hmm. but being way too drunk, and like everybody else isn't, like you're on like level 11 and they're all at like 4.
Yeah.
You know, they're sitting in a car and we were stopped in traffic.
This wasn't barreling down the freeway at 80. This was,
that was the horrible part that like I found out later. I mean, the whole thing kind of like revealed itself to me in painful, you know, increments. But yeah, I was doing this like in gridlock traffic, and you know, my friends were just sort of like, you know, waving to the people like, sorry about that. Yeah, I make the joke, you know, in the book that it's kind of like being like stuck in a grocery line with someone who's like drunk and mooning you, you know, you're like can't leave, you know. So this was horrible to me, you know. And and again, you know, it's I should explain, you know, I've been talking about this book quite a bit, and a lot of times I am confronted with the fact that people really don't know what blackouts are and they confuse them with passing out. And so I always try to make the, you know, to clarify it again and again is that, you know, that you drink, you basically drink to a point where the long-term memory shuts down. It's the hippocampus, which is in charge of long-term memories. And so you're still engaging with people, but you don't remember it afterwards. And it's just this incredibly freaky thing.
It's like almost like your mind's on autopilot somehow.
Yeah, you can still make decisions. And, you know, like in legal cases and stuff, they've found that you are still conscious, but your recorder's not going. Mm. And for me, that kind of like brings up the question of what is consciousness? Because if I don't remember it, how am I conscious? But apparently people in a blackout, they can do things, you know, they can drive, people driving cars,
yeah.
They operate machinery. I mean, I've heard many chilling stories of people doing things in blackouts and they don't have any memory later of what they did.
And this story, you know, you were at least with people who were kind of looking after you and making sure you got home safely. You had other situations where that wasn't the case that could have ended quite literally disastrously. I wonder what it feels like to realize that these things have happened, that some of them have happened because of the things that you were doing and saying and the places you were going, and yet have no memory. I mean, I've had dreams before where I do horrible things and I wake up feeling guilty even though I realize it's not true.
Yeah, exactly.
And I wonder if
I have the opposite.
Okay.
You know, that's so interesting that you said that, because I think you know, when you have a blackout, you have a total disconnection from your behavior. So it's the opposite of what you said. You did something, but you don't have any memory of it. So you sort of feel like, well, I don't need to feel guilty about that. And if you are a blackout drinker, you become very accustomed to reading the cues of other people's bodies the next day and their body language and stuff. I couldn't sleep when I drank very well. I couldn't sleep very well. So I would wake up and I would wait for everybody else to wake up, you know, and it was kind of like waiting to see if they were mad at me.
Hmm.
And, you know, was I going to be confronted? Did I do something wrong? Did they have an edge in their voice? It's just an enormous amount of management. But at the same time, I also got sort of too accustomed to it as well, where I just, if I didn't remember it, it didn't happen. So I had this total disconnection from it. It's such a strange thing. And I think that disconnection, you know, one of the things that I've had to, for years when I was drinking like this, I always said, it just affects me. My drinking only affects me. I wasn't married. I didn't have kids. And I told myself that again and again and again. And what the process of sobriety, as well as writing this book, has taught me is how much my drinking affected the people around me. And just because I couldn't remember it, it doesn't mean it wasn't happening. And just because they didn't tell me necessarily, some of my friends are like this. You know, you're fine. You were great. It's okay.
No, because they love you.
They love you. And they also know that I beat myself up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I am a very self-punishing person. Like, I'm really hard on myself about my writing. I'm really hard on myself about my appearance. My friends are so aware of my own perfectionism and how it plays out in my life that for them to tell me, no, you weren't fine. That's so hard. And so sometimes they would just kind of, you know, they love me and they want me to be happy. And so what do you do? This is another really difficult question. What do you do with the person that is in trouble, you know, that is close to you in your life? How do you enable it? Or do you pull back? Do you confront? What is the dance? You know, my friends were all doing that dance. And my parents who didn't really know what was going on because I was living in New York by this point. They were in Dallas, but they could hear the pain in my voice when I would call. And they wanted to help me and they didn't know how. And I think it's very painful for them to read this book. You know, I hurt more about that than I do about anything else. Is my, you know, a lot of parents, kids do crazy things. They do crazy things, and most parents never have to sit down and read a published record of that everyone else is going to read.
Your mom seems to blame herself.
Well, I told you a little bit about that self-punishing thing. That may be a little inherited, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that my mom, like any mom I've ever known or come across, has regrets about the way you know, about who she was as a mom, whether she should or shouldn't, like that's a different subject. But I think moms that I know, like they're always second guessing what they did. I should have done that. I should have done this. If I'd done this more, maybe this wouldn't have happened. There's two things going on. One of these is the extraordinary love that a mother feels. And then part of this is like taking on more responsibility than you probably should have, you know, like my mom and I, though, were very close. We talk all the time. We are such talkers. And we talk a lot about this thing, you know, like, where did this come from in me? What are the factors, you know? So I want her to kind of understand what are the things that she needs to let go of, you know, because I don't know that there's anything that my parents could have done to keep me off that bar stool. When I look at how much I wanted to tunnel towards that drink, you know, they could have done things, but I mean, I wasn't even that bad in high school. So that's when I was in their house, you know? I don't know. I hurt for them because I think it's hard to know that your kid was in pain and you couldn't have stopped it. But that's also a lesson of parenting, right? That you can't protect your kids from everything in the world.
Were you always looking for someone who was worse than you were? Who drank more than you did?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's classic. Yeah, you always do the like, oh, well, that guy. Yeah, that guy's here every night. Or like, you know, there would always. And also, I didn't do drugs.
Hmm.
You know, I never did drugs. So, and that's such a common thing to experiment with in high school and college. And so you always had your friends that were kind of like rolling on E or maybe doing coke. And it's like, what are you guys doing? I just drink. So yeah, that's a very key part of the keeping what you do normal, is you surround yourself with people that drink more than you. And as I got older and I inched into my mid-30s, finding people who drank more than me was becoming a harder and harder thing to do. Mm. You know, I started hanging out with like people at the bar on the corner, you know, because they were at the bar all the time, you know. That's why it's good to find your friends in bars. They have the same priorities.
How did you believe that drinking affected your writing?
Well, when I first started writing, I didn't have any. I mean, I just wrote because I loved it, and it was an expression, and it was almost like a friend. You know, it was like I had these things, and I wanted to capture them on the page. So there was freedom, just beautiful, honest, creative expression. But as I got into my 20s, and I got a job at the Austin Chronicle, I feel like my head became a little bit more of a corrupt space. I was so aware of my failings. I wanted to be better than I was. And I was really, everything I said didn't seem good enough. Nothing felt good enough.
Everybody was cooler than you, knew more than you.
Oh my gosh. Everybody was cooler than me. Everybody knew more than me. All my ideas were not original. You know, it's a very classic young writer thing. You go through this despair of like, everything's been written. And it's like, yeah, it has. But not by you.
Hmm.
And you learn that eventually, but I was in that place of despair. I'm not good enough. They're going to figure it out. I'm a fraud. I was always afraid of that. And, I was on an assignment. It was the night before this big piece of mine was due at the Austin Chronicle, and I just couldn't start. Like, I literally I'd just been staring at the computer screen, and I couldn't get a word out. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to give this a try. And I just started drinking wine. And that's what I did. See, that's what I had learned to do when I needed to put myself out there. You know, when I needed to calm my nerves and get it, you know, go to the party and ask that guy to do whatever. You know, like, that's what I had learned. So this is what I needed to do. And it did the trick. I mean, this was the horrible lesson, was that it worked. And then, you know, and I got so many accolades for that story, and it really started to feel like, all right, so this is like a manageable creative process, right? Like, mm-hmm. I drink a little bit and then I get going, and then I just, you know, and I just need it to get started. Well, then that changed, and I got a little bit bolder with it. I mean, you know, with all these things, there's also, you know, you're just always trying to like push the envelope of how far can you get. I do remember, this is like in my 20s, and I would drink myself really crazy, and then I'd just sort of like clatter on the keyboard and see what happened. And, you know, and I would wake up and be like, you know, it's not like terrible. Like, I wouldn't publish it now. It was kind of like, that was the creative, I needed to access the creative surge. And then the next morning, I would wake up early and I would edit, you know. So this was how I dealt with like the superego and the ego, or something like that. You know, you quiet one, you build up the other, and then you quiet the other. So you can, you know, somehow that felt manageable to me. And it worked for a while. It helped me get over that terrible, terrible stage fright that I had. It was really just writer's block, stage fright, whatever. And, you know, then by the time I was in my 30s, I had gone many years that I did. I don't want to make it sound like I always had to drink to write. That's not true. Because sometimes I would feel really confident, and writing came very easily. But then as my internal world was kind of cratering and I was becoming more anxious at work, I got a job at salon.com. And one of the things that happened was that I was writing for them, and the online commenters, that whole world, that was so brutal to me because I had been fighting with the voices in my mind.
Now you've got 8,000 people.
Now I have. It's like all the voices in my mind have been externalized, and they have usernames. And they have a lot more time on their hands to tell me about how terrible I am. And that was, it was brutal. Because all these years I'd just been, my mom used to tell me, like, you're your worst critic. And it was like, oh no, I can point you to five different users at least that are much worse than me. That was so brutal. And I started to really lose my nerve. And I think when you lose your nerve as a writer, that's when you teeter and you stop writing with that confidence and that authority, and you start needing other crutches. And so, yeah, so I started leaning on the alcohol and the booze more. But also, I was working really long hours at Salon. It was like one of these crazy 70, 80-hour a week jobs. And the alcohol became, it felt like it was a reward, like I deserved it, you know, like if I'm gonna shoulder this much stress and anxiety and responsibility, I'm going to get a bottle of wine at the end of the night, you know, and you start rewarding yourself that way. And that becomes part of the pattern.
The sort of after school special movie of the week narrative of alcoholism and recovery is
yes.
that there is the cataclysmic rock bottom event. And it seems
yes.
like you had a bunch of like boulders tumbling to the ground, but it wasn't one thing in particular.
Yeah, it's like my rock bottom moments had a very short shelf life. You know, I would have these things and I would be like, this is it. Because I expected that too. It's a total after school special narrative version of it. And
like you can hold out till that happens.
You just got to hold out till that happens. And then there's something that's going to come along and it's going to be so bad that it's going to be very clear and apparent that I have to quit. And what you hope when you're in this part of your life, what you hope is that it will be big enough that you will be scared straight, but it will be non-permanent. You won't hurt somebody else, you know, that somehow you will get out of it undamaged. So you keep hoping for that. Again, it's this pushing the envelope thing. How far can I go? How much longer can I put off change? Because as humans, we don't like change. Change is incredibly uncomfortable. Most people will put it off as long as they can. And a person in a drinking addiction is no different. And so I'm waiting for this rock bottom moment to occur. And like you said, boulders were crashing. Things happened, bad things happened, and I would cry in my bed, and I would scream into my pillow, and I would say, I'm not doing this again, I'm done, and I would know it, and then I would drink the next day, or I would drink 4 days from then, and it's like, after you keep doing that, your words don't have any meaning, because you can make, I mean, think about that, like, if you make a promise to yourself, like, how do you know you're going to keep it? Because you know, you have integrity. That's what integrity is called. It's your word. If you keep saying, I'm not going to drink today, and then by 3 o'clock, you're like, but you know what? I'm going to not drink tomorrow. Then you lose your footing. You don't have anything. And that was a terrible place to be, to not believe myself. I mean, just saying I was going to quit drinking was worthless. And so what happened was I just got tired. You get tired. There's a saying in recovery, when the pain outweighs the fear, then change happens. And that happened for me.
Sarah Heppala is my guest. She's personal essays editor at Salon and author of a new memoir called Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Sarah Heppala about her new memoir, Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. When you realized you had to quit, you were initially pretty skeptical about 12-step programs or AA.
Mm.
You quite literally would shut yourself in the closet every night.
Well, I had discovered I was having panic attacks. And things felt uncontrollable, and I had discovered that if I shut myself in a closet, it somehow quieted me down. I think the drinking had calmed me for so many years that when I didn't have it, there was an eruption, and there was something strange. I don't really understand. It's that fight or flight reflex that the panic attack is, and then I've been told something like, you know, animals, you know, it's our animal instinct, and you feel like animals are going to come get you. So if you're closed off in a space, that might quiet you. That's what it did for
yeah.
me. And I didn't understand it. I didn't know. All I knew is that when I got into that very tight space and I closed the door, that I was calm. And I could pretend like nothing else in the world existed. I felt so exposed and vulnerable too. Alcohol had very much been a kind of battle armor for me. And so without it, I felt too raw I think I used, you know, I had turtle skin, you know, I couldn't, it was very, very hard to handle just regular old life. And I was living in New York City at the time, which is kind of a tough environment, you know, just getting on the subway, people shoving into you, people, you know, yelling or saying rude things. I mean, all of that just felt too much. And so what do? You hide like a wounded animal, you know, I was hiding in this closet.
One thing you write about here that I found really compelling that I haven't seen elsewhere, you know, we love recovery narratives, right? We love to hear about somebody who was a disaster and then they got clean and we're so happy for them. You had to grieve for the loss of the experiences you'd had, yes, some of which you really treasured that were, yes, linked to alcohol. And that's a much bigger process than just the process on its own of deciding not to drink anymore.
It was so hard. It was a mourning process. When I would read recovery memoirs, it seemed like a lot of them, there was this feeling of like, when you finally get clean, it's like, yay, sober.
Rainbows and unicorns.
Rainbows and unicorns. And to me, it was like, I wanted that. I wanted that, believe me. But I didn't feel that way at all. I felt like the great love of my life had been ripped out of my hands. Drinking had been companionship, it had been identity, comfort, all of the things that I, you know, when I felt uncomfortable, I went to drinking, and I didn't have drinking anymore, so what was I supposed to do with the discomfort? The first year of my sobriety is one of the hardest times of my life. The only time that would be comparable maybe would be being 12 years old, which was also awful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have to say, getting through that year is one of the best arguments for never going back, because I don't want to do it again. I never, ever want to go through that again. You know?
Did you tell people right away when you tried to get sober, or were you still afraid that you couldn't keep your own promise to yourself?
Yeah, I was totally afraid. And also, like a lot of my friends, I had told them I'd been relapsing for about 2 years, you know, this like, I'm going to quit. No, never mind. I'm not quitting. So they were a little tired, but also confused. Because they would think I wasn't drinking and then they would find out I was, and what do you say about it? And so I didn't say anything. I told my mom. That was what I did. My mom still believed me. And sorry, I sometimes get choked up when I'm talking about my mom. So I would talk to her every night, and I could tell her anything. And I didn't tell anybody else. I didn't tell anybody at work. Because I was afraid to walk. I was tired of walking it back, and I was tired of all of it. So tired of myself, and so I just kept it to myself. I went to meeting. You talked about my being very skeptical of the recovery community. I was just so. It's a classic example of like, oh, that program's a cult, and I don't want any part of it. And the God thing freaked me out. And then I started going to AA meetings, and I didn't like them. It was a very, very slow burn for me. But it was the first place that I could be. It was really the first place I could be myself, because I had been pretending with so many other people. So this was a place that I didn't have alcohol to kind of screw with the dials on me, you know? And I could just be myself. And I didn't like it, by the way. I didn't like being myself. Sometimes I would just go to meetings and I would cry. And it was like, I hate being myself. It's the worst thing ever. But when people see you and then they say, well, that's okay. You know, you're okay. It's okay that you're like that. Then you start to realize that you can be okay and be yourself with other people too. And you can take that out into the world. I always felt like meetings, AA meetings, were like training wheels. I learned to talk in those rooms. I learned to talk honestly about my feelings, examine myself, examine my own behavior, and then I could take that into the world, you know, and be that way outside too.
At the end of all this, you learned something about your dad that, like, it seems like you would have seen before, but you were kind of in your own cloud of addiction.
Yeah. My dad and I went to lunch. We were talking about drinking, and he said that he thought he had alcoholic tendencies, and I was floored. You know, when I was in college, my mother, who I've mentioned before was not much of a drinker, kind of said to me once, like, I think your dad might be drinking too much. And I was like, Mom, you're not a drinker. You don't get it. you don't understand. And my dad was drinking, like, it was never out of control. You know, it was that classic sitting in the armchair and having three glasses of wine, maybe four, maybe the whole bottle.
It didn't look out of control.
Didn't, certainly not. And it certainly looked nothing like my drinking. And he had to quit drinking 10 years ago because of some medications that he's taking, and because he just did it. See, I didn't. I mean, I couldn't do it on my own. I needed a program. And because my dad just quit, I just thought, well, I guess it wasn't that hard. It wasn't that big of a deal. But he told me that it was. And that there were two things in that conversation to me that were so significant. One of them was, again, the genetic link of drinking and alcoholism. You know, I'm Irish and Finnish, and so I have it. I have the bug on both sides of my family tree. The other thing was how much I don't know my father. My mother is the talkative one. She's a therapist. And my father is an engineer. He's very shy and he's quiet. And he was always there, but we never talked. And I didn't realize, like, how can you be with, like, it's always this thunderous thing, right? Like, with parents, you know, I know other people have this experience too. Like, how can I know you for 40 years and I don't know these things about you, you know? Like, I had never asked. Why had I never asked that, you know? And so then it sort of became kind of more renewed about asking him more, you know, finding out more about him, because I am so much like my father too. Everyone says that I'm like my mom, but I'm really a lot like my father. He's very diligent and he has kind of a worrying gene, and we're very self-conscious. We have that Scandinavian darkness, you know, and I have so much of him in me, and it's one of those weird things where you kind of look at your father, your mother, and you're like, that's in answering the question of how did I get here? Where, like, that's how you got here. It's them. They're in you, you know, and knowing him is knowing myself too.
When you go out now to a place like a restaurant where people will be drinking.
Yeah.
Can you look around the room and instantly laser focus on you 15 years ago?
No, but the first year of my drinking, 2 years, I couldn't do that without just laser focusing on the drink. I mean, I would just watch it like a red laser that goes across
like
the room.
Like a starving person.
Oh my gosh, totally like a starving person. I mean, I just couldn't. And you know, early in those years too, smell was really big for me. And if somebody was drinking wine across from me, that was really hard. You don't think of wine as smelling, but it does. Beer especially is a very powerful trigger for me. So I couldn't really be in bars where you would get that hopsy smell.
Yeah.
It's been 5 years for me. And so a lot of that stuff is in my rearview mirror. And I want to be very careful not to hang my mission accomplished sign, because I have to stay vigilant in my recovery. But what I mean is that I get to lock in on the conversation with the person across from me, and I get to focus on what they're saying and, you know, what we're talking about. And I'm not distracted by all these things going around me, you know, the glasses coming into the table or whatever. What will take me back is seeing a drunk woman, seeing a young drunk woman hoisting her beer up in the air and hooting and hollering. And I can see that she feels free. And I remember what it was to be that girl feeling so liberated by the booze, you know. And I think, oh my gosh, like, that was me. And I always feel, I actually always just feel connected to those women, you know, because whatever brought us to, but then, you know, then you also see girls that are like falling down drunk, you know, and that's the other thing where it's like, oh, that was me too. You always have to remember the second part, you know, it's just like, you always like, yeah, that part was fun, but there was all the dark stuff and the painful stuff that came after it.
And I guess you have to realize, like, maybe I don't know how maternal you are toward those women, but there's the instinct to go up to them and say, honey, let me just save you, you know, decades of pain. But I would imagine that when you were in that place, no amount of solicitous contact from a stranger would have made it would have made you laugh.
Chris, if you had walked up to me and said that, I would have thrown beer in your face. Maybe somebody else's beer, because I wanted my own. No, I'm not an advice giver for that reason. I never took it. What I do, and I do have very maternal urges, mm-hmm. but I am very grateful that women who need help find me, women who want to quit. I can't convince anyone to quit. I don't believe. Yeah, maybe. But what I can be somebody that lets their hand, you know, reach out when somebody wants to grab for it. You know, like I have endless empathy and a nurturing impulse for women who want to quit and don't know how, because that's where I was for so many years.
What's the division when you are trying to help someone between like understanding and empathizing and also in the way that all good mentors do, not taking any nonsense when people are talking themselves into justifying something that can't continue?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that you have to keep really good boundaries and be good. It's kind of like all the things that you do in mentoring. You're right, you know, like what I do is, well, and tough love is so hard too, because my first instinct is soft love. Mm-hmm. My first instinct is like, oh, I know it's hard. Yeah, it is really hard. I know it's tough to quit drinking. And then you have to kind of like draw the line and be like, right, if you want this thing, here's what you got to do. And I got to be straight with you. This is what I did. It's the only way I know. The only way I know how to get sober is what I did. I know there's other ways. I've talked to people. I've seen them. I've heard them. But they're not the ways I got sober. So if you want to know how I got sober, this is how I did it. And I do have a certain amount of empathy. And at the end of the day, there's also just kind of like, if you want it, you do it yourself. I can't do it for you. I can't give you that gift.
Did writing this book, I mean, did it tell you, okay, I really believe this is going to hold? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it would be weird to write a sobriety memoir if you were still worried that you could, you know, imminently have a relapse.
Yeah. I think like in David Carr's memoir, he advises against reading or writing a addiction memoir in the first year of recovery. What I know is that I wanted to throw myself fully into sobriety, heart and soul, because I had done it half. I had done it half. Let me, you know what? I'm going to just do yoga instead. And like, let me see if that works. And I'd done all these half, you know, half measures, and they weren't working for me. And I wanted to throw myself into it completely. And the more I could lean in, the steadier my sobriety became. The more I learned about who I had been, the less I wanted to go back to that. The more I could do the thing that I had wanted to do all my life. I had wanted to write a book since I was a kid. That was the dream. That was the dream. So, I mean, that was the magical thing. And I never could do it. I was always the person at the bar talking about the book they were going to write. When I knew that I had to make my sober life something that I could be proud of. Because otherwise, why would you stay in it? And I knew that it was going to be hard, you know, that it was going to require a lot of effort on my part. So you start looking around you, you know, how can I make this something that feels good, that I don't have to drink my way out of? So you look at like deepening your friendships with people, becoming more comfortable in your own skin. And as far as from a professional standpoint, doing the long sustained work that you have always told yourself you could do.
Sarah Heppala is personal essays editor at Salon.com. Her new memoir is called Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. Sarah, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. We had help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.